Hello, everybody. Welcome to Rumors, Money, and Movies. As always, I'm your host, James Stone. This is the 91st episode of Rumors, Money, and Movie History. The countdown continues in October. First week of October, we will have our 100th episode, our series finale. Later in the show, we will have Andrew Tite joining us, not Andrew Tate, for a great interview, CEO and founder of Catch. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at RMM_901. I don't really use that app anymore, but what I'm more important interested in is follow me on Letterboxd at JABMYRIC. I follow back. So if this is your first time listening to the show, if this is your 91st time listening to the show, check out the Letterboxd. You can look at it up. You can download the app. It's free. It's a great resource to film criticism and film reviews, and it's a lot better than Rotten Tomatoes. I just wanted to update everybody on the box office since we didn't really talk about it last time when we had the Oscars post-show episode. By the way, if you haven't listened to that yet, please do. If you're interested, had a lot of great thoughts. You know, the Oscars don't really matter that much, but I think we did a good job reviewing that show objectively and honestly. Now, going through the box office quickly, the month of March this year was up year over year compared to 2023, which is a very good sign because April looks very light other than Civil War, which is, God bless, if you're going to go see that. I will not be partaking in Alex Garland's vanity project. And February and January were very weak. So it was a big thing that March was up year over year, and that was mainly because Kung Fu Panda opening weekend, $58 million. This was March 8th, led the box office to $136 million. That was up over the same weekend from 2023 and was the first weekend to be up year over year. Kung Fu Panda then won again in its second weekend for $30 million, leading us to $87 million total box office domestically. Ghostbusters, which I don't know one person who saw that film, made $45 million opening weekend, leading us to $103 million total domestically. And then Godzilla Kong, which just came out, which, as many of you know, I was a big proponent of the Godzilla Kong Monsterverse. 4, 5, 3 years ago, I was very excited for Godzilla vs. Kong, mainly because from a pop culture perspective, it was the first time they were really going to get a proper introduction to each other. That movie was not very good, and I heard this movie was also not very good. If you liked it, fantastic, good for you, God bless. I heard from channels that it wasn't very good. It got $80 million opening, and I also heard the villains were terrible. I mean, I read about the villains, and I was like, ooh. $80 million opening weekend, $136 million total for the box office. That was also up year over year. So those two films plus a very strong Dune hold. Dune's going to get up to like $700 million at least. So Dune 2 is doing very well at the box office, which I think a lot of people who watch Dune are happy about. Kung Fu Panda is doing very well at the box office. Godzilla Kong is doing very well at the box office. And the last thing I wanted to say is right now Warner Brothers is dominating the early box office revenue. They have over 30% of the box office to start this year. And it's only going to get higher, or relatively so, because Godzilla Kong, and Dune 2 are also going to be doing very well this month. And there's, again, not that much coming out. So that's very interesting to keep an eye on, because usually, you know, I don't think anybody's expecting that number to stay at that level. But that was just something that I circled and was looking at, because as Bruce Nash, the numbers, who we interviewed in a previous episode this year, he was writing about how Warner Brothers is the only studio to really launch a franchise successfully during COVID lockdowns. And they did two of them, MonsterVerse and Dune. So it's very interesting. And we'll monitor that situation as we head again to off-season series finale. But I hope you enjoyed this interview coming up with Andrew. I knew him personally. I worked for his company for about 6 months. And I hope that you enjoy the interview. And if you're listening from the Cash family, I'm glad that you're here. And I hope that you enjoy the podcast. And if it's your first time, I hope that it's worth your time. Interview's coming up. Thank you guys for the introduction. You guys heard in the introduction, I introduced our guest. Well, now he's joining us. Co-founder and CEO of Catch Data, Andrew Tite. Not Andrew Tate. I want to make that clear. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, no, of course, James. Really great to be here with you today. And yes, I'm not Andrew Tate. I think that's the worst thing that's ever happened to my name. outside of when I was bullied as a kid for having tighty whities. You know, Andrew Tate, you have tighty whities. It was very embarrassing.
I mean, if somebody's drunk, it sounds the exact same. So I had to make that joke. I'm sorry.
No worries.
So again, thank you so much for joining us. And we'll talk a little bit about catch and we'll get into all of that as we progress here. But I start, and I already know, I'm afraid of what the answer is going to be because I kind of have an idea. But I start off with every guest that I have two questions. What's your relationship with film? And then what's your favorite film?
Wow. Great question. Relationship with film. I would say it is, my relationship with film is almost like a dream. It is where I go to escape. It is where I go to shape how I feel emotionally. When I have a nightmare, it affects my emotion for the entire day. The same is true for me when I watch something. Well, it'll be something where I'll notice I'm in a bad mood and I'll be thinking, why am I in a bad mood? I'll remember that, you know, one of my favorite characters in a TV show broke up with their girlfriend and I'm just like in the show. And it's like, why is this affecting my day? But ever since I was a little kid, it was my way of escaping. You know, the reason I saw Avatar 5 times in theaters was because when I went to see it, it just completely transported me to that place, that moment. Yeah. Avatar is a very great movie. Not my favorite. I think my all-time favorite, there's kind of two I'll give you. One obviously is Gladiator, because it transports you back to that time. It, you know, there's a study that talks about how that a lot of people see their quote unquote favorite movie when they're about 13 years old, which is interesting. It actually makes a lot of sense because it's where you finally are stepping into yourself in puberty, becoming your own adult, becoming your own person and making your own choices. And so Gladiator was one of those first movies for me. And then James, you probably know my other favorite, which is About Time, which I see you shaking your head. And
that's all right.
Oh, it's so good. For me, there's only two movies that I've ever watched where they ended and I pressed play again. And one was About Time and the other was Pirate Radio, which is, funny enough, the same director. And I didn't know that at the time.
I don't like Richard Curtis, so God bless.
You don't like Richard Curtis?
Not at all. I don't like him at all, but...
Well, that's so interesting. I see. This is why my taste is so fascinating. I think Richard Curtis is probably my favorite director or one of my favorite directors. And it's just fascinating how two people that would probably, we do fall into the same demography, have differing tastes, like polar opposite actually.
Yeah.
Which is awesome. I love that.
Yeah, no, it's just funny. Cause so to also sort of, I mentioned this in the preview, but you know, when I was working with Andrew at Catch, you know, everyone would always make the joke about Time. Don't say anything bad about Time. Don't mention About Time. But yeah, do not read my letterbox on that movie. All right. So,
hey, honestly, there's no, that's okay.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I love about film, that, you know, I didn't like Parasite, yet it won Best Picture. You know, I stopped watching Succession. I hated Tiger King. And those should not be clustered in the same cluster, yet they share many similar attributes. Mm-hmm. And that to me is the joy of filmmaking, is the joy of storytelling, is that, you know, you can find what matters to you. The fact that we don't all have the exact same taste is amazing.
Yeah, and there's so much, and we'll talk about this later, but you know, there's so much leeway, what different artists and different genres, you know, you could have a very, the corporatized Hollywood big budget films and then have far, you know, indie avant-garde cinema. And over the generations, it all evens out. And build off that point about your love of wonder of film. You're now at Catch, before you were at Lionsgate, but how'd you get into film? What was your career like before these two big companies when you were just a little professional?
A wee little lad. What got me into film? I've always been into film ever since I was just a kid. I would get up early on Saturday mornings before streaming services, get up on Saturday, you know, sit on the couch, wrap myself in a blanket, stick my thumb in my mouth and like watch all these cartoons. And I just loved it because, you know, I would get sucked into, you know, Recess or Rugrats and be in that world. It was so real to me. So I was obsessed with storytelling from that point. And so always wanted to be involved in it. I didn't know how, whether it was an actor or a director. Andrew in middle school didn't know what a producer was, but I discovered that that was really my route through the years. Applied to film schools, didn't get in. And I was applying kind of pre-Google, or kind of right when Google was becoming a thing. And so you couldn't really just Google, you know, top film schools. And so all I really knew were, you know, NYU, USC, LMU, UCLA. Those were really the only ones I knew about. I didn't really want to go to NYU since it was, you know, more of a quote unquote flag school. They didn't have a campus. They didn't, or not much of a campus. Yeah. And I really wanted that big college experience. So I applied to USC and UCLA and didn't get into either of those. And so I ended up going and getting a degree in communications with a focus in media from UC Davis up in Northern California. Absolutely loved it. But the minute I graduated, I was down in LA.
Anteaters, right? Go Anteaters, right?
No. UC Davis is an Aggie, agriculture.
Okay. I don't know why. I thought.
No. I think it's the. I don't know who's the Anteater. Maybe
there is a UC that's an Anteater. No, isn't there not like UC?
Oh, maybe Irvine.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. UC Irvine.
Slugs out in Santa Cruz and the agricultures. I think there was a push to rename them or reclassify them as the cows since it is Cowtown. And I was like, you know, moo, you know, it just sounds like you're going to just have this echoing of booze everywhere.
Yeah,
and
literally.
That's probably not the best brand. So moved to LA right when I graduated and kind of just took any odd job I could get. You know, I was a PA on a set, and then I did a lot of background work. I was in an episode of How I Met Your Mother, which was sweet since that was my favorite show, and did just a lot of that catering work, anything to just be in the industry to make money so I could continue to pursue my dream. Ended up, you know, volunteering to work with a movie producer and writer director, and just worked with him for a couple years until we ended up making a bigger movie, and then wound up at Lionsgate.
That's great. So you end up at Lionsgate, obviously, if you're not familiar, it's a mid-major, I would say, right? The biggest non-big major studio. So how was that like? What did you start doing there? How did your career progress there?
Yeah. It's an interesting story. I had just finished working on this movie, and it was a, you know, straight to DVD or sci-fi horror movie for Anchor Bay, which ironically was owned by Starz, which ended up getting by Lionsgate many years later. But I had finished that movie thinking that, all right, we're going to make this movie. Then I'm just going to make movie after movie after movie. You know, it's going to be, you know, skyrocket to the, you know, the stars. And that wasn't happening. But when I was between my senior year of high school and my freshman year of college, they were shooting a movie in my hometown. And I volunteered to be a free PA on set. And it was just a great time. I loved it. I didn't really know anyone. I just walked up and said, "Hey, can I volunteer to be on set?" And they said, "Sure." Cause it was a well-financed student film, very well-financed. I think they had over $1 million. So it was a low budget feature.
Yeah.
And out of the blue, 7 years later, the producer on that film, on that student film called me and said, "Hey, any chance you're looking for a job?"
Wow.
So clearly I made an impression at the time of just, you know, working hard, being a good guy. And he called me up and said, "Hey, are you in LA?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "Any chance you're looking for a job?" And I said, "Sure." And it was basically to be his replacement as the head kind of creative executive for all animation for Lionsgate. I didn't know anything about animation. I loved kids' movies back when I was a kid, but that wasn't really the route I was going. But a mentor of mine, this woman, Sarah Risher, Sarah was the chairman of production for New Line Cinema for about 20 years. Is responsible for, you know, Ninja Turtles and Nightmare on Elm Street and, you know, Lord of the Rings. So important person. She told me, I asked her for advice, should I take this job in animation at Lionsgate? And she was like, for lack of a better word, you know, a better way of saying it, she was like, Are you effing kidding me? She was like, take the effing job, Andrew. Like, there is, why wouldn't you take this job? You know nothing about, I think she said, do you want to be a producer? And I said, yes. Then she said, do you want to make studio films? And I said, yes. And she said, how much do you know about the politics of green lighting and how movies actually get made in the studio? And I said, I don't know anything about it. And she goes, that's why you take the job. Take the job, get on the inside, learn how it works. Because if you can understand how the sausage is made or the movie gets greenlit, then you build the relationships, you build the understanding, and then you'll be able to make movies in the future with these studios. And so I said yes, and turns out I actually totally loved producing animated movies. And so, you know, went into a deep dive in how you produce animation. And so ended up doing about 10 movies with Lionsgate, and it was an absolute blast. Learned a lot, made some good movies, made some shitty movies, but just had a really fun time doing it. And it was a great experience.
One thing I was wondering, I was looking through your catalog with Lionsgate, and it wasn't like you made the next Fellini film or the biggest film of the year. So I'm just curious, like, A, how would you describe, I mean, you said it was a positive experience, but how would you describe sort of the nitty-gritty of that, working on these films that you know may or may not be
critically acclaimed? Oh, man. Yeah. Oh, I'm the first to tell you, you know, one of my first movies there, I think had a 0% on Rotten Tomato for a little bit. I think it balanced out at about 9. And so none of them are critically acclaimed. Mm-hmm. None of them are good by probably your or, you know, anyone else, any adult's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But then take that movie, put it on, and, you know, I've watched my 2 and 4 year old nephews watch it, and they lean in, they laugh, they enjoy. So does it matter if Andrew Tite likes it? Not one bit. The only thing that matters is, can I make a kid laugh? Can I, you know, give their parents a break for 90 minutes when this is on a screen? And that's really how I started to measure success. That's not how I started, because, you know, when you start working on these things, it, like, what people don't realize is how hard it is to make a movie. It takes, you know, minimum 2 years. It is, you know, what's interesting. So let's double click on animation. So animation is a medium where you see every penny on the screen. So let's use live action. Let's say I have $5 million. All right, I have $5 million, but I'm friends with Brad Pitt and with this great director and this great cinematographer. And they'll say, hey, you know, I'll just do this for points on the back end. You know, let's just make this movie for the cheap. You can take $5 million, and especially with tech these days, and make it look like $20, $30 million. If you have $5 million in animation, it'll look like $5 million. Like, so little goes to the voice actors. And frankly, the celebrity voice actors are not that good. The best voice actors are voice actors that know how to be voice actors. And they don't cost, you know, high six figures, seven figures for this role. They cost, you know, much less than that. And so you get the best voice talent, but it won't look as good. And so, you know, my favorite reviews that I read from this movie, Norm of the North, were, oh man, this doesn't look anything as good as Frozen, or it's not even close to the quality. I'm like, no shit.
Yeah.
This was a $5 million budget.
Yeah.
And Frozen was $200 million.
Yeah.
We were $5 million and we made 40. Seems like a pretty good return on my investment. If you're me, you know, that's pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. And so I think the main thing that I learned in this process is it gave me a lot more, maybe more accepting, frankly, of movies that aren't as quality,
mm-hmm.
That maybe I might not like, because mm-hmm. it is, when you're making it, like, what I want to tell people is, this was so hard to make. This is so much better than it could have been. So many people in the know in animation will watch Norm of the North or Alpha and Omega or Rock Dog and say, wait, you made this for 5? Like, this looks like 10.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the important thing, is that, you know, can you push your budget beyond what it is?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of how we measured success.
Mm-hmm.
But it there's nothing shittier than reading a bad review and being like, damn, you know, I wish people liked this more. But at the same time, you know, I made a movie and people saw it all over the world. And there are some people that love it and some people that hate it. But that's all right.
Yeah, there's, I mean, every movie's a miracle in some sense, but
so much.
Yeah.
It's more. And then last thing, the
Go
best
ahead.
Part to me about making a movie, if you're a producer, is, and I implore any producer that listens to this to do this, and a lot of people don't. You typically give this to your editor, is be the person in charge of creating the credits. You know, actually be the person that goes through and types out every single name. Because what you end up realizing is how many people it took to turn this into a reality. And one, that's cool because it gives you the appreciation. I made it my goal to say every single name out loud, so that it was just part of my routine.
Yeah.
But the other part of it is looking at every single one of these people. It's because of this movie, whether you like it or not, because of this movie, this person was able to feed their family. This person was able to go on vacation. This person was able to have a job. And that's the amazing part about making movies, when you're, especially if you're producing, is you see how many people are involved in the creation of this. And that, I think, is the single greatest thing about being a CEO and being a producer, is you are doing something that is helping someone make a living. And that's awesome.
Yeah, it's, if you can't tell, if you're listening now and you don't know Andrew personally, he's just a great guy. Because, and I wouldn't, I'm saying it, but I, you know, I'm not one of those people that was gonna, I'm not gonna like deride somebody with all intents and purposes.
Outside of Richard Curtis, obviously.
Or the opposite, I guess. But, you know, that's something that I think is really great to hear, you know, because I feel like there's a certain sense in the film industry, even working in it slightly, it's like, and this is not just the film industry, there's a lot of industries, honestly, it's like sense of entitlement. Like, someone owes me. But, you know, as a producer, as a leader too, it's like, you know, even like the short films that I've done, your crew and the people that you work with are like, those are the people that are allowing you to carry out your dream. Because even if you're the greatest writer ever, even if you're the greatest director ever, you still need at least 10, 12 other people at the bare minimum to make a movie. No, probably more like 250, 300, 400, depending. So it's just, I actually really appreciate that story that you just said about reading the names out, because that's something too that I think everyone can kind of learn from and take with them in a positive way. Because it really does take a village to make a movie.
Oh my God. Takes a village. Your villages, like, family that live in another, you know, country. It just takes a hell of a lot of luck just to get it greenlit. And then once it's greenlit, to get it made. And then once it's made, to make it on budget. And then once it's made on budget, to get it into distribution. And then once it's distributed, to have people see it. You know, like Norm, we released that, and it was Martin Luther King weekend 2016. And that weekend, we were hit with the polar vortex, if you guys remember that. And like the entire Midwest, all the theaters closed because there was this crazy snowstorm. And, you know, you can't predict what's going to happen.
No.
And, you know, you make, what is it, like 80% or 50% of your budget in the opening weekend? I mean, your total box office,
yeah.
You know? And so, like, if you get hit with that, it's like, shoot, you can't come back from that. And that's just bad luck. But whatever. You made a movie. That's all that matters.
And so why did you end up leaving Lionsgate to start Catch?
Oh, man, a bunch of reasons. I mean, my dream was to make movies, and I was making movies, and that was awesome. And I still love making movies and would love to make more movies. But I just had this itch that there was something that I wanted to do, and it was to try and solve this problem, which was trying to understand, you know, why we like what we like. Case in point, how we started. I love Richard Curtis. You quite the opposite. And that's interesting. And I thought that the way that we were engaging with audiences was broken. And so the thought was, could we have a better understanding as a creator or as a distributor? Who is the actual audience for this piece of content? And how do we find it? How do we help find that audience and help them find our movie? Because, you know, I'm a firm believer that every movie in the world is someone's favorite movie. You know, there are people out there that I know this is true, that love Norm. Like, I got fan mail of people that were obsessed with this movie, and this was a movie that was not good. But that's okay. Yeah. It just means that taste is subjective.
Yeah.
And, you know, what I like to describe it as is, if you can understand, if you make a movie and it's awesome, who are the people that are going to totally love this? And how do we, you know, grow that audience? You should be rewarded for making something that's fantastic. And if you make something that's not great, how do we find the people that will actually enjoy this, right? Because you might still be able to make back your budget. And if you make something that's really bad, then shoot, you probably won't make back your budget. And so really the idea was, could you figure out why we like what we like? And I started playing around with that idea, and it was just one of those things that I would spend every night working on, every weekend working on, until all of a sudden, you know, I was working 80, 90 hours a week as a producer, and then another 20, 30 hours a week trying to build this company, and ended up getting to a point where I was, you know, I had just delivered the final Norm of the North in the Norm of the North franchise, and was just saying, man, I feel like I really want to take this to the next level. I need to do something new. And so I gave notice and, you know, jumped off the cliff and said, let's see what this is. And I think the crazy thing, James, is that when I gave my notice to Lionsgate that I was leaving, Nolan wasn't even a part of the company yet. And for those that don't know, Nolan is four co-founders, but he's really the brainchild behind the way we do everything. And so it was just that sometimes in life, you just need a jump and just say, I'm going to trust in myself. I'm going to believe in myself, and I'm going to see if I can make this work. And when I did that, you know, less than a month later, Nolan went from potentially being an advisor to being a co-founder. And that is really the thing that changed my life forever, was that one moment. And, you know, I think that if you hold yourself back, I was having this conversation with a former intern the other day, and we were talking about how, you know, he had started a production company with his friend and was kind of a little bit, he was kind of ready to stop and actually go and try and get a job at a talent agency or at a production company, but just kept on, you know, doing it. He was too afraid to have the conversation or nervous to have the conversation with his friend that he started this company with. And I give him the advice that every single day you are staying here, you're missing out on the opportunity that could change your life forever. Because if you are staying here, you're not looking for a job. And that job might be the job that leads you to your future. It's kind of like if you're in a relationship with a romantic relationship with someone that you know is not right. Every extra day you stay there, you are potentially missing the chance to meet your husband or wife. And that's really important. And so the minute you know, sometimes you just got to jump and also look at what's the worst that can happen. You fail. Okay. That's all right. Failure's not bad. You know, the thing that, and I know I'm rambling, James, so I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I was going to say one thing, but I don't know if you know about, I forgot the name of the theory, but there's a theory behind this. It's like, if, let's say you're like just doing good enough. Like if you were in a worse position, you'd be better off because then you'd make a change. You know, like if you're in a relationship that's like not terrible, like let's just say, you know, you're not really loving her or whatever, him or whatever, but it's okay. But if it was, you're not going to break up with the person. But if you were actually like in an abusive relationship, that would force you to break up with them, which then would lead to like a net positive result, because then maybe find someone new. That's basically what you're talking. It's like a whole theory of like psychoanalysis behind this. But anyway, continue.
You're exactly right. Yeah, I think that's basically that's exactly. I think that people apply that to romantic relationships more than they apply it to career decisions. And you should think about your life and your career this way.
So first of all, what is cash for everyone who doesn't know? I'll let you explain that and then sort of the humble beginnings of it.
Yeah. So Catch is a taste-based data company. We build contextual metadata. So we look at a movie, a show, a short form piece of content, like an Instagram reel, and analyze it into all of its core elements. So, you know, what are the, you know, the variables aesthetically, stylistically, thematically that make up this piece of content? And if you can think about this, if every single movie, every show, every reel is analyzed into the same taxonomy, the same variables, when you merge that with behavioral data, you love this reel, this reel, this reel, this movie, et cetera, all of a sudden trends appear. You might realize that you like, you know, a type of instrumentation or a type of, you know, story arc, et cetera. For example, in the beginning, I talked about how I didn't love Parasite or Succession or Tiger King. And those shouldn't be clustered together, yet they are, because I ultimately realized that I have a really hard time resonating with a piece of content that has unlikable, unethical main characters, which is interesting. But I love likable, unethical main characters, kind of like a Neil Caffrey in White Collar or in Catch Me If You Can, Leonardo DiCaprio's character. I love a con man, especially if they're likable. And so that's what we're able to do. So we generate this great data set that we can license to our clients, like, you know, Warner Brothers or Paramount or AMC or Meta, to help them better understand their content so that they can engage their audience more effectively. And ultimately that hopefully benefits all of you, everyone, by helping you discover content that you might not have seen. You know, that right now, the way it works is that, you know, here's the new movie that came out. Here's, you know, Black Adam, or, you know, I don't know, the new Disney Star Wars movie. Let's shove this in your face. And for some people, that's right in their taste profile. Hell yeah, let's see it. But for other people, there might be, you know, this great movie called Lunchbox that is a Bollywood film that fits your taste profile. Wouldn't it be better to guide you towards that? You know, I just, on the plane yesterday, I started watching Guy Ritchie's The Covenant. And yes. I'd never even heard of this movie. And I started watching it. And so I started watching it on the last hour of my flight. I was sitting until the last second trying to watch as much of this movie as possible because it was just so hitting my taste profile. And I'm just like, why didn't I see a trailer for this? Why did I miss this? How many pieces of content exist that would be perfect for me that I've never seen? That is really our goal, our hope, is that we can help people discover things that they actually love.
See, as you talked about some of the, I guess, accomplishments, Paramount, AMC, Warner Brothers, Meta, which is Facebook. You know, how do you think Catch has gone? Because it started in 2019, correct me if I'm wrong.
That's correct, yeah.
Sort of 5 years now, the company's been on for 5 years. Now, how do you kind of view where Catch is and where does it fit in with the current industry?
Oh man, it's come a long way. It is a absolute roller coaster. And this is the single hardest thing I've ever done in my life, which is saying something since I was a collegiate rower and a semi-professional cyclist, but it is wicked hard. There are so many great days and so many, you know, absolutely gutted days, but I've never once looked back and said, man, I wish I didn't do that, which I think is really important. So I feel like, I mean, there's a great book called Good to Great. And there's a line in that book, and if I'm misquoting, just, you know what I'm talking about. There's a great book where called Good Great, where they talk about getting the right people on the bus. And I read this when I was a producer, and nothing struck me more true than that statement. If you get the right people on the bus, the right director, the right crew, et cetera, you're in production, you're going to hit speed bumps. You're going to, think people are going to drop out of the project. You're going to, have to do left, right, up, down turns. But if you have the right people, that's all good. They'll go with the flow. Mm-hmm. It's the exact same thing in starting a company. You need to have the right people, because if you have the right people, no matter what happens, you will be able to adjust. We started with a B2C recommendation app. Our goal, and one of our main goals in the beginning was to solve the problem of my girlfriend and I sitting on the couch trying to decide what to watch. Mm-hmm. Her taste, my taste, join together, figure out what we can watch. But we realized that there was this bigger problem we can solve for the entertainment industry as a whole. Mm-hmm. And so we had to pivot. And guess what? That was the best decision we made. And then we had this opportunity with Meta where, oh, wow. We aren't just film and television. We could do this in the short form space. Mm-hmm. And so you have to change again and change again and change again. And that is the nature of being in business. And so I am utterly amazed. If you were to step back and pull me aside when I was walking down the halls of Lionsgate, walking to my boss's office to tell him, hey, I'm going to step away. If you had stopped me, paused me in time, right then and said, hey, Andrew, in, February 2024, this is where you're going to be. These are the people you'll have contracts with. These are the people you're going to know. This is how much revenue you're going to have. I would have been pretty blown away. Mm-hmm. So I'm amazed with where we are. And how do we fit into the industry, into the ecosystem as it stands now? I think, we're becoming more and more critical. With more streaming services, with more AVOD platforms, with more fast channels, and more content and global content, the idea of having everything searchable, analyzable, it becomes more and more important. Mm-hmm. But to take it even one step further, in June/July of this year, June, July, I think, is the deprecation of the third-party cookie, meaning that you can't be tracked as easily on the internet. And so in the future, without cookies, you need to rely on what you would call contextual advertising. What is contextual advertising? Well, making sure that you place something contextually relevant next to something else that's contextually relevant. So if you are showing a movie and the movie is a kind of a gritty, dark, gloomy mood, and then it gets to the commercial break, because guess what? AVOD is back, everybody. Commercials are back. We're all going to start watching more commercials again. So if you're in this dark and gloomy mood and it pops out and it's some, sunshine and daisies, happy music, it just snaps you out. And that's not actually good. And so what people want is to put contextually similar pieces of content next to each other. Okay, well, if that's the case, if we have a genome, a way of analyzing short form content, AKA an advertisement, and we have a way of analyzing the content it's going against, we can contextually match those together. So I think that there's incredible opportunity to be the solution in the third-party cookie-less space, in the contextual advertising space moving forward. And that's what I'm utterly thrilled for.
I don't want to ask you a question about that. If I'm speaking out of line, please tell me. No. But I remember when I was an intern with you guys, my professor was asking me what I was doing. And she's a documentary filmmaker, French, very traditional film theory from the European perspective. And she was like, gasped when I told her what I was doing. And I didn't think about what she was saying when I was an intern. And even what you described, do you ever think about, or maybe have response to this, sort of the codification of art, this idea that we can reduce art to an algorithm or like a number of like we can predict what someone wants, as opposed to like the inherent nature of like, you know, the human spirit and the art form. You know, how do you rectify those both personally and as a, you know, how do you come and approach that?
It's, I mean, it's one of the biggest, most important things to pay attention to. So as it pertains to the codification of art, I think that that is, we codify everything. Right now, it's being codified by genre. You described it as a documentary filmmaking. Is it documentary? Does that make, I mean, that's classifying it into something. So in reality, it's getting far more granular, providing more color to that description. And, you know, just because right now the way it works, I didn't like Parasite. Oh, you don't like foreign films. Got it. No, I didn't say that. I don't like Parasite because it's, you know, even though I watched it and I was like, okay, I can understand why this is good, but I didn't like the characters. I didn't like all these other things. I love plenty of other South Korean content.
Yeah.
And so if we only, and I don't love, you know, some documentaries, but I loved Quarterbacks on Netflix. I love, you know, some other, you know, ones that have an aesthetic appeal to me. And so what I love about this process is the discovery aspect, getting people, showing people, breaking down genre. I don't like horror movies, quote unquote, but I love Get Out. Okay, that's interesting. And so I, you know, that's the part that just really brings me joy. I think the big misconception of our type of data, and this is because so many people have tried to do this and sell quote unquote snake oil. If you do X, Y, and Z, you're going to have a hit. I mean, James, be honest, if I find out that I can predict a hit, then I'm not selling this to anybody. I'm raising a boatload of money and making a ton of hits.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to buy an island or, you know, a ski resort or something. Like,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
That's, it's not possible. And so it's, if you can understand who your audience is, you know, the way I like to look at this, one other way is, if you can understand before you make something, if you execute your vision the way you think you're going to execute it, will this resonate with the audience that you think it will resonate with? Because here's the idea. And this is something I ran into producing, and I just gutted it and luckily got it right. But it was, I thought my audience was X. And so I made all of these decisions, everything from, you know, the voice actors I hired to the, you know, the themes that we covered in the story to the music we selected to satisfy audience X that I thought my audience was. But what if, and this happens all the time, what if I think my audience is X, but in reality it's Y? I make all my strategic decisions to satisfy X, when in reality it's Y, and that actually might turn Y away. So now by me making these decisions without even considering the fact that, oh, you know, this other audience is actually going to be the audience that's going to love this. And there might be, it might be something as simple as you had a chance in the trailer to pick, you know, a pop song, and you chose Taylor Swift instead of, you know, Justin Bieber or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that is where I think this kind of data is powerful, in my opinion.
I love it. I love it because it's, it, I mean, it does, I mean, let's put it this way. I mean, the current state of the industry, which will be my final question is, you know, I was just talking to recently Bruce Nash, who's a box office expert. We had a whole discussion about it. You know, it's a lot of sort of what you're getting at is, you know, these people are somewhat fed up with this corporate idea that we're going to make a cinematic universe. So this idea we're just going to make a franchise that maybe people aren't really asking for. And I guess, you know, that's kind of what Catch's goal is to stop that from happening. You know, don't invest $200 million into something that no one really asked for. That's not going to really make any money or justify its own existence.
Well, I think I agree with you. I think it's also, you know, and this is, I'm not trying to throw anyone under the bus here, but let's look at Lionsgate. So Lionsgate, we made this amazing franchise called The Hunger Games. The Hunger Games 1 and 2, I thought were outstanding. I think they kind of got a little bit lazy with 3 and 4, but, you know, I still loved them. So, oh, wow. Okay, this works. Let's make Divergent. And Divergent was a book series, dystopian future. There were essentially, you know, districts, if you will. It was about a kind of a female lead. It was, you know, carbon copy of Hunger Games. And they thought that was it. Oh, and you know, I know how hard it is to make movies. So that's probably not exactly true. But it was kind of like, oh, well, let's just carbon copy this and go. It will sell itself.
Yeah.
When in reality, there's so much more that makes Hunger Games work. And I'm pissed because I, you know, I'm a selfishly or secretly a YA fan. And so, like, whatever. So just take, guys, my taste profile is wild. Just take it with a grain of salt. I have the taste profile of a teenage girl. But I love the Divergent book series. And so I was super excited for this. But it, to me, they didn't give the story the respect it deserved.
Yeah.
And so I think the issue is that you can make Batman. You can make Joker, right? You know, didn't love Joker because it was scary. I did love it. It was disturbing, but I really enjoyed it, but it was so disturbing.
Yeah.
But it was a great take of taking a superhero story and making it different. Take Christopher Nolan's Batman movies, right? Zack Snyder versus Christopher Nolan. No offense to Zack Snyder, but they're not as good as the, in you know, traditional sense, as the Christopher Nolan Batmans.
Hey, Rebel Moon for Best Picture, everybody.
Right. You know, which one?
Rebel Moon. Rebel Moon.
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's go. No. But, you know, what's so interesting is you, like, step back and you look at that and you say, I mean, it's we did it at Catch. We compared the Marvel Universe versus the DC Universe. And Marvel, in up until Endgame, frankly, was excellent. They and so it, or if you just look at the Marvel to now versus, I mean, to Endgame and then after Endgame, it seemed as if they relied on the universe. We wouldn't be having this discussion if every movie from Marvel kept the quality of Endgame. We wouldn't have this discussion because it would continue to be great, but it hasn't been. And so that to me is, take Barbie. You know, I think Barbie, I thought, was outstanding. And now we're going to get a lot more, you know, toy games. I mean, toy movies. But if they treat it with the same respect that Barbie was treated with, then it will be successful and it'll be awesome.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't, you know, content, storytelling is the most important thing. If you tell a great story, it doesn't matter if it's about a toy, if it's about a cinematic universe, or if it's about, you know, a girl that is, you know, wants to be a singer and her family's deaf. It does not matter. All that matters is this a compelling story? Every story is a story about characters, people, and how they interact. And it just so happens that it's a apocalyptic zombie show. You know, I mean, The Last of Us, right? Last of Us is a show that happens to be a zombie show. But to say, oh, The Last of Us, that video game zombie show, is doing it a huge disservice. And so that, I think, is the future, is if we can treat content with respect and do our best to make something that's really good. Then I think we have a bright future. But if we don't, then we'll lose people to short form content, and who knows what will happen.
I do think that,
for those that can't see him, he's crying because I'm just so emotional. And
I'm like, I can't talk to this person. And okay. So as we wrap up here, Andrew, I give also another, the opening question is the same for everybody, and the closing question is the same for everybody. Floor is yours. You can plug whatever you want, talk about whatever you want personally, professionally, whatever. Go ahead.
Oh man, I think the most important thing, and James, you know this, I think the most important thing for me is to be kind. I think, kindness is our number one core value at Catch. It is something that stereotypically Hollywood's not known for, but I think it's getting better and better. No matter what, don't put up with people that are not being kind. And if your boss happens to be an asshole, which there's plenty of them, don't turn into that person in the future. I think there's a way that we can move beyond that stereotype. And I think it's really, really important that we go beyond that. We do a speaker series at Catch where we bring in guest speakers. And the one rule is we will never have a speaker that is not nice. And I think that that's really important. And so just continue to pursue that. Pursue, spreading kindness, because, if we do that, the world will be better. And if it's better, then we are happy. And if we're happier, we make better movies. And then I get to see something that's awesome. And that's really all I care about is seeing something that's awesome. So yeah, outside of that, just go out and say yes, do stuff, have fun, and be brave, and other really important things. But yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that's great advice too. That doubled as my advice question. So that's fantastic. And, like I said earlier, I worked with Catch and it was a great experience. So shout out to them. I mean, one experience that I'll say personally about Andrew was it wasn't even that big of a deal, but I just remembered it was, I went back for another term and there was like 12 people in a meeting or whatever it was, 16 people. And we were all talking about each other. And, I applied. There's like, there's what, how many interns? There's 70 interns a term or whatever it is. And I remember Andrew, like we're in this meeting or whatever, we're like he's getting ready to start. And I was talking to somebody else, and Andrew's like, "Yeah, James, you go to Richmond, right?" And I've like never spoken to Andrew before. Like I speak in only like in meetings generally. Like we never actually had a conversation. And I was like, wow, okay, like that's crazy that he remembers where I went. Cause obviously it's not even like it's a big school or anything. And we didn't even talk. So it's like, that attention that means, because one rule story is not the every story, but it's a general means of what the stories could be. So
Yeah.
thank you, Andrew, for that. I appreciate
And the person that created the Minions went to Richmond. So
he did.
yeah, and he named the Minion after himself, Dave. So there you go. Go Spiders.
Viva la Spide, we say. Viva la Spide.
Viva la Spide,
or
or
roll those.
little brother, Roll Spide.
Yeah.
All right. Well, have a great one, James. Really great to see you. Let's stay in touch, all right?
Absolutely. Thank you guys for listening. This was Rumors Running Movies. Thank you to Andrew. Have a good night, everybody.